Well, welcome. So there's this story I want to look at today, and I've been thinking about this for a little while, and I thought today would be a good day to talk about it. It's a regular story. I'm sure I've preached it before. It's a parable of Jesus, and I can't remember when I preached it last, but I figure if I can't remember when, then you probably can't remember when, so I might as well tackle it again. But on Facebook this week, yesterday I just posted the question. So what are we going to do with this bag of gold anyway? And so that's sort of that's the title of this message. What are we going to do with this bag of gold? And that might give you a little clue as to what story this is. But I want to start with this is a parable, and so if we sometimes don't understand parables. We sort of misunderstand them. So I like to break down words and tell you what they mean. And a parable literally means, so para is the word beside. And the end of the word parable comes from the Greek word ballo, B-A-L-L-O, which means to throw. So a parable literally means to throw to the side, right? Which is a strange way we're like, okay, well, how does that help me? Or another way you could say it would be like to scatter. And in fact, when Jesus tells one of his parables about scattering seed, in that parable, he talks about why he uses parables, right? So he's like, I'm throwing things to the side, like I'm scattering things, which is sort of like, let the chips fall where they may. Like I'm throwing this to the side so that it will do something with you, to you, in you. You may grab it. You may pick that up. It may take root or it may not, right? So that's kind of, that's a little bit of what the nature of a parable is like. And it reminded me of what my kids often ask me. And recently I have not responded affirmatively enough to them, but it's usually my daughter. She'll come up and she'll say, some evening, and she'll say, Dad, can we do the scare game? There's this game we play called the scare game. And recently I've been a little too tired to do the scare game because it takes a lot of energy on my part. But the scare game is we turn off all the lights in the house. And any place inside or outside is available. We've played the scare game. We've moved it outside in the winter before. But the scare game is all the lights are off and I go hide somewhere and they try to find me. So it's usually me in a closet or in the bathtub or in the basement, just waiting, playing on my phone, while the three of them are roaming around the house with like a tiny little light that they usually find a light somewhere, a flashlight or something, and they're trying to find me, knowing that when they do, I'm going to scare the living daylights out of them, right? So that's the scare game. Like, that's what's fun. So one of my favorite places to hide is in the basement. And we have, it's not a finished basement. It's like, we don't hardly ever go down there, but it's big and it's concrete and it's got all kinds of junk in it and toys and boxes and just sort of stuff everywhere. And so, I mean, stuff from when they were real little kids. And so I'll go hide like right under the stairs in the basement. So they come down the stairs and I can see them coming from either side. It's completely dark. And usually when they start creeping down, like they go as slow as possible. I mean, they're just giggling and, you know, like kids are. And I'll grab a toy or a ping pong ball or something that's going to make noise. And as they're coming down the stairs, I'll throw it like all the way across the room, like way over into the corner. And so it thuds against the wall and they hear it and they get scared and they're like, where is he? Where is he at? And of course, you know what I'm doing when I do that. Like I'm making them think that I'm over there, right? I throw it off to the side to draw their attention over to the side so that when they creep down the stairs, I come around the back and just terrify them, right? It's really quite a fun game. They like it as much as I do, and then they go running and I chase them, and it's a great game. But this is what parables are like. Like, parables are like the scare game. It's something gets thrown to the side, right? It draws our attention somewhere, and then it comes around the back door and hits us when we don't expect it, right? That's what a parable is. So when we read the parable, we often go to it and we say, okay, so this parable is describing something that we're supposed to know. If that's how we read the parable, we're reading it wrong, right? The parable is not the thing. Like, it's not describing the thing. The parable is drawing our attention over here to hit us in the back, to come through the back door and get us, right? And to be honest, the parables don't do that so much for us as they did for their first hearers or readers, because we don't live in that culture, right? So we don't understand a lot of times all the things, that, all the layers underneath that the people would have understood. But it's a good way for us to go and see what parables are doing. That when we read a parable, a story of Jesus, the intent is not to describe the reality of the world. The intent is not to give us sort of the laid out truth about how things are, right? The intent is for the readers or the first hearers is to disrupt, it's to shake up, it's to disturb, and to open up, right? And so that's what parables are for. And so that's a helpful way, I think, for us to come to them. And so a lot of times we go to a parable and we go like, well, what does this mean? You know, how do we figure that out? And even as we figure out what it means, we need to understand that it's even its own meaning is not the thing, but it's the disruption that it was causing for its first hearers. And so this story is Matthew 25. I'm just going to read the whole thing, and it'll be on the screen, and you can follow along, and we'll just read the story together. Jesus is talking about the kingdom of heaven. In Matthew, that's how it's phrased. So the kingdom of God, and he says this. Again, it will be like a man going on a journey, who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. To one he gave 5 bags of gold, to another 2 bags, and to another 1 bag, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received 5 bags of gold went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 bags more. So also the one with 2 bags of gold gained 2 more. But the man who had received 1 bag went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received 5 bags of gold brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 bags of gold. See, I have gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share in your master's happiness. The man with 2 bags of gold also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with the 2 bags of gold. See, I have gained 2 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share in your master's happiness. Then the man who had received 1 bag of gold came. Master, he said, I knew that you were a hard man, harvesting where you've not sown and gathering where you've not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your gold in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you, his master replied. You wicked servant, so you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed? Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. So take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags. For whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. All right, well, what a story, right? You've probably heard this one before, I'm guessing. And who knows what you thought of it. But it is quite a story. So the first thing I want to say is right off the bat, especially because we come right out of this ending with this weeping and gnashing of teeth, the first thing we say is that, man, this sure seems like a story about judgment, doesn't it? It seems kind of harsh. It seems kind of rough, like this guy who buried his talent just weeping and gnashing of teeth. And I'm here to set you straight. This story is absolutely about judgment, right? This judgment is a huge part of the story, and we're going to get to that. But judgment about what is the question, right? Judgment about what is the question? We see this man who's buried a bag of gold in the ground. What does that mean? Right? What does that represent? We could go all sorts of places with that. And in fact, many of us have been taught what this story is about, and that if we do these things or don't do these things determines whether we get the judgment or don't get the judgment. And so I'm just going to suggest that we need to think carefully about this. We need to look at this carefully. And then the other question is that all that the story is about? Is it only about judgment? So I'm going to say, yes, it's about judgment. Is it only about judgment? No. right? It's about more than that. And so in this story, much like a parable does, it throws to the side. The judgment in this story is not the thing. The judgment in the story is what points us to the thing, right? So it ends with a sort of harsh kind of judgment. That's not the thing. This is not some description about how things are going to be, right? The judgment is there to point us to something else, right? Because that's what parables do, right? It's the scare game, right? And it's really interesting to, as we talk about, there's going to be some fear in this story, as there already is. Like, we have fear, perhaps hearing it, there's going to be fear. And so, on the one hand, there is judgment, but the judgment is there to point us to a thing. And here's what the judgment points us to. Well, we're going to get to that. I'm not going to give it away just yet. All right, so let's start at the beginning. A man goes on a journey. All right, a man goes on a journey. This is the beginning of the story. What I love about this is usually when we come to a story like this, we start assigning characters, right, to find the allegory, find the match. So the man going on the journey is obviously who? It's the master. Who's that? God, right? Isn't it interesting that Jesus tells a story that begins with God's exit from the scene? It begins, God leaves. In religion and church, we talk a lot about God existing, right? Oh, well, there's all these reasons we should believe that God exists. But in this story, it doesn't begin with God exists. It begins with God exits. God gets out. God takes off. God leaves. God abandons. That's a difficult thing for us to grasp, right? And that's not to say, I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, God is always present. But in our experience of life, there are times when God feels like he's gone. And we might even know that God's not really gone, but that's when we have this experience of, I don't have answers, right? Not having answers is an experience of God having exited, of God having left. When we lose, right? We don't win, we lose. Like, we lose people, we lose jobs, we lose money, we lose things, we lose stuff that's important to us, right? When we lose, that's an experience of God having made an exit. Sometimes when we just don't believe anymore, when we have questions and we have doubts, that's an experience that God has exited. And if you haven't had those experiences, you certainly know people who have. One of the interesting ways to think about that is when you run into somebody who has questions, who has doubts, who seems like they don't believe anymore, to come at them with the approach that for them, it's as though God has exited. Right? The experience of having God exited. The reality is these are all real parts of life and faith. Like, these are just real parts of living. And I love that Jesus includes this in the story. In fact, he begins the story with this because they are just real parts of what life is like. And I think we should celebrate them. We should celebrate the experience of the exit of God at the beginning of the story, because it is that sort of thing which does what parables do. It's that sort of thing that opens us up. It's that sort of thing that shakes us, that disrupts us, that disturbs us. And we often see that as a negative thing, but really that's a positive thing, right? That the ground gets shaken up just a little bit. But it's also terrifying. And for people who experience it, for the times when we experience it, when it feels like life's kind of on edge, when it feels like stuff's not really working out, that's a terrifying moment. That's a terrifying moment. And even if we're not really thinking, hey, God's gone, we're like, God's got this somehow, I just don't know how, still the experience for us can be terror, right? It can be fear. It can be being afraid. And so this story begins with God's exit. Now, the next part that it goes to is, and I love the story, is that as God exits the story, the master leaves, he does something really mind-blowing. He entrusts his wealth, the master entrusts his wealth to slaves, right? It says servants in there, but really we're talking about slaves. So you imagine a master who has slaves. He gives his slaves bags of gold. Now, it says in some of our readings, it says talents. We've heard this as a story about talents, which is probably not the best way to describe it. But a bag of gold that is being described here would be equal to 20 years' wages. 20 years' wages. So if we go like $50,000 a year, let's say, 20 years' wages, $1 million, right? Did I do my math right? Yeah, $1 million. That's a lot of money, right? That's a lot of money. So 20 years' wages. Imagine a master who's leaving has slaves, and he gives the smallest amount to one slave, $1 million. This is yours. Do you know what this is? Like, this is a massive gift. It's a massive gift. It's an exorbitant amount of money. And it's given to a slave. It's actually ridiculous. It's a ridiculous thing to have done. And the fact that he gives it to slaves, it's backwards. Like, you don't give a massive amount of money to slaves. You give them to, like, the guys right under you, right? The guys in charge. But he gives this massive amount of money to slaves. It's an exorbitant gift. Now, this story is told for a reason, right? It's told for a reason. It's drawing us into thinking, to imagining, or it's drawing its readers into imagining which character they might be. Right? And we're going to find the character around which this story is centered really, really quickly. But this sort of completely outlandish idea is Jesus throwing this to the side. It's sucking his readers in so that something can be done to them through the back door. Right? And so it leads us to think. You know, it might lead someone to think that, well, the point of the story is to connect to people, right? The point of the story is not to make you think like you're not a part of it. The point is to connect. And so what it's saying is, even the guy who gets the smallest amount, the one bag of gold, he's like the hearers, right? That's Jesus' intent. He wants to connect his hearers to the guy who gets the one bag of gold. So in other words, here's what he's saying. You're just like him. He's saying, no matter how little you think you have, what you actually have is an exorbitant amount. Right? No matter how little you think you have, what you actually have is an exorbitant amount, an outrageous amount, something way beyond what you could possibly deserve. Right? So that's how Jesus begins. Now, we'll move to the next part. We have this idea that he gives one of the slaves five, right? He gives another two, and he gives another one. Why does Jesus throw in the differences, right? Why does he throw it? He could have just told the story about the one and had him go bury it rather than do something. But he throws in these differences for a reason. I think it's related to what we think about what we have, right? Or for his readers or his hearers, what they thought about what they have. And I want you to think carefully, like, this story is not about money, actually. Right? This story is not about money. It's another example of throwing the thing to the side, right? It's not about money. It's about something else. So I want you to not think in terms of money, but think in terms of life, right? What we have in life, right? And one of the things that often gets distorted for us, our inability to see what we have in life, happens when we begin to notice that someone else has two, someone else has five, someone else has 10, someone else has 20, and I have one, right? Right? When we begin to look around and we see the comparison, we start to go, well, wait a second, I don't actually have that much, right? Like, the ways that my life is going, really, compared to everybody else, is not that much. This is what I like to call the Instagram trap, right? For those of you who aren't on Instagram, maybe you're Facebook people, right? It's the Facebook trap. The Instagram trap that's a photo social media. So you post your photos. I don't know how many of you go and follow people on Instagram, but when photos get posted, it's usually not like the spoiled dinner, right? It's usually not like the broken down washing machine, right? It's usually not like the way I really screwed up my kids yesterday, right? It's usually not that. It's usually the great vacation, the new car I just bought, the happy face, the perfect family, right? It's That's what gets put out there. It's the Instagram trap. And we begin to think, and in fact, I talk to people and they go, well, it just seems like all these other people are doing so well. Right? It seems like the people around us are so happy. Right? It seems like my neighbor has it together. It seems like, right? That's the Instagram trap. It seems is false. It's just not true. None of us have it together, right? None of us have it going for us. No, we have moments when it's going pretty good. Like we have good times where we're like, man, I'm really grateful. But usually those moments are not connected to how we compare to everyone else. They're connected to the way we see what we've been given. Our ability to be grateful is what happens when we stay away from the Instagram trap and we go, look, I've got a bag of gold. Everyone else might think it's nothing, but I think I've got a bag of gold. All right, so far, this crazy story is about a massive gift to slaves. It's a massive gift to slaves. And so the first slave takes his five, and he goes and he doubles it. The second slave takes his two, and he goes and he doubles it. But the man who received the one bag of gold buries it in the ground. So this story is really about him, right? Everything's funneling us into this one character who had one bag of gold, and instead of going and doing something with it, he goes and he buries it in the ground. He fails, right? He is the failure in the story. But the important question for us to ask is, how does he fail? Like, what is the failure? Because if we get the failure wrong, then we will misapply this. Like, we will make a mistake. And for example, one of the ways that we come to a story like this is we have in our imagination, it's sort of been handed to us, the idea that Christianity is basically a massive exam, right? That life is basically a massive exam. That we have been given a syllabus, and we've been given a grading rubric, and we've been given all the requirements that we need, and the amounts of times we need to show up to class, and the homework assignments that we need to do, and we've been given the book that we need to pore over, we need to master the material, we need to do all the activities, and at the end, we're going to find out if we passed or if we failed. Pretty accurate picture of the Christianity that often gets talked about, right? Right? And so it's because of that, it's easy to come into a story and see it, right? It's easy to come in and say, oh, this is what it's about, right? It's this massive exam. Man, we better figure out what this is so we don't fail, right? But if we read Jesus, Jesus has already turned this idea that Christianity is this massive exam, he's already turned it upside down. He's already obliterated it. He's already said, he's gone to the test givers. He's gone to the people who made up the exam, and he said, oh, by the way, the people going into the kingdom of heaven ahead of you are all the people who failed your exam, right? It's the sinners, it's the outcasts, it's the cheaters, the tax collectors, the prostitutes, all those people, they're entering in first, right? He's already obliterated this. So when we come to the story, we need to sort of let that be obliterated too. We need to say, well, wait a second, but maybe it's not about this. Maybe it's about something else altogether. And so it's easy for us, however, to come in and to see that. This is sort of how religion, including Christianity, always wants to turn back into an exam. It's like it just has this natural move that this is about me achieving, this is about me doing. In fact, when we first read this story, some of you probably had this sense of, oh, I got to do more. I'm not utilizing my gifts. I'm not doing the things that I should. Maybe I could do better. I could be more spiritual. I could pray more. I could, you know, you could have had all sorts of thoughts or even just feelings that you weren't thinking kind of running through your mind. But I want to suggest that this is not that. Christianity is something, actually we might say Christianity is the obliteration of that if we're really paying attention to Jesus, if we're really following what he's about. And so let's dig into why. How does this character in the story fail? We see it in a couple of lines. He says, I don't know if I can get these back up on the screen. Let me see if I can find them. We've got the well done, good and faithful servant, which again gives us that, that thing. Okay, so the man who, here it is, the man who received the one bag comes, and he says, Master, and here's his first mistake. I knew that you were a hard man. I knew that you were a hard man. The real question there, is he right? This is where he begins to get off. I knew that you were a hard man. How many of us, when we imagine God as this, this examiner, who at the end of it all is going to tell us whether we did it right or we did it wrong, how many of us really deep down imagine God as a hard, harsh, full of sort of retribution, ready to fail us if we don't quite get it right? Right? The idea that the master is a hard man is where the guy starts to get it off. And it's easy for us to believe this, especially when we read a story like this and we get to the end and it says this part about weeping and gnashing of teeth, which we'll get to in a little bit. But the harshness with which we view God is the determining factor, right? The harshness with which we view God, like how harsh do we think God is the leads directly to how much we're afraid and then to how much we hide and then to how much we fail to use the gift we've been given, right? You follow that train of thought? Depending on how harsh we think God is, leads to how much we're afraid, which then leads to how much we hide, which then leads to actually the failure that's being talked about in this story. And I love that phrase. I mean, it says, I knew that you were a hard man, harvesting where you've not sown and gathering where you've not scattered seed. I love this line. So I was afraid and went out and hid your gold in the ground. That line right there. So I was afraid and went out and hid. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Has anyone heard that phrase before? It's somewhere else in the Bible. Do you know where? So I was afraid, or we were afraid, and we went and hid. Adam and Eve. Yeah, Genesis. So it draws back to I don't know if Matthew meant this, but he did it maybe on accident. Like, it draws back to the Genesis story. Like, the place where it all started, I'm not even sure the place where it started was that they pulled the fruit, but it's they got afraid, and they went and they hid, right? And that's what we do when we fear God. We tend to hide. And so we get to the end of this story, and there's this massive judgment. Like, this judgment that says, hey, kick that guy out. Get him to the outside where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. And that strikes in us what? Fear. So wait a second. This whole story pokes at a guy whose problem is he's afraid. And then he hides, right? And then it ends by making us afraid. That doesn't make sense. It shouldn't do that. Right? It shouldn't end with us being afraid. The whole point should be to not make us afraid, but to make us not afraid, to make us like the guys who had the five and the two, right? And so the judgment, this extreme judgment, is not the thing. It's the thing that points to the thing. The extreme judgment is meant to draw us back into something else in the story. Right? The extreme judgment, this massive judgment, draws us back to the massive gift, right? It's so extreme. It's so outlandish. It's meant to point us back to this so extreme, so outlandish gift at the beginning of the story that God has given this guy a bag of gold, and he got scared. Why get scared when you have a bag of gold? 20 years' wages, $1 million. You're set, right? You're set to do with it whatever you please, right? So the extreme judgment draws us back. In other words, it's like, for us, rather than looking, we tend to want to look at what's going to happen, right? What's going to happen at the end? Like, what's the exam score going to be, right? Instead of looking at what's going to happen, it draws us to look back to what has already happened, right? Not the fear of what will happen, but the gratitude for the gift that's already been given. So if our conclusion at the story is to be afraid, we've already missed it. Right? If our conclusion is to be afraid, we've already failed, because fear leads to hiding, right? And hiding leads to missing out on the point. Now, there's kind of another view about this judgment, that the judgment is not really about what's going to happen somewhere off in the future, but the judgment is actually about something that has already been manifest in the present, right? And we see the same thing with the two guys who had the five and the two, and they doubled them, right? What does the master say? Well done, good and faithful servant. You've done well with these small things. I'm going to put you in charge of many things. In other words, you're not done working. Like, the task keeps going. And then he says, come and share in my happiness. Come and share in my joy. Is this master an angry, bitter, harsh, retributive man? Or is the master someone full of joy, inviting people into the gratitude which he has already given and saying, look, you've done this, let's just keep going. And I think the master is supposed to be seen as the second. And so for Jesus' hearers, he's drawing them into the reality that they're missing out on something that's already right in front of them. They're missing out on this exorbitant gift that has already been given. It's right here. It's right now. And we do the same thing. When we end this story in fear and judgment, the future, you know, damnation, whatever that's going to be, when we end it there, we miss out on the point. Like, that's looking at the thing that got thrown over in the corner while Jesus is coming around in the back door and saying, surprise, right? There's something deeper to look at. But of course, Matthew is telling this to his readers not because they should worry and be afraid. He's telling this to his readers so that they can begin to see the life that's been given them right now. In fact, Matthew's readers, we know this, were very likely scattered already. They'd already lost. God had already exited. This story was probably, or this Matthew was written probably 80 or 90 AD. So I talk about this all the time. The destruction of the temple has already happened, right? The Jews have already been scattered. It's this group of Christians who don't quite fit in with the Jewish folks. They don't quite fit in with the Gentile folks, and they're trying to find their way. Why would Matthew include a story about this if he's wanting them to be afraid? He's not. He's drawing them into the generosity of the gift. We see the same thing in Jesus. The Pharisees, the teachers of the law, they thought Jesus was coming to bring the nation back to power, to make things all work. And did Jesus make things all work? Nope. But what did he do? He found life in the woman at the well. He found life with his ragtag group of disciples who never seemed to get it. He found life with the tax collectors and with the cheaters and with the prostitutes. He found by offering grace and forgiveness and mercy and love to all of these people around him, just in everyday life. It was like, you think something's going on over at that temple. You think something's going on over with the political systems. You think that that's where this is at. No, no, no. This is the life we have is what's right in front of us. It's in the daily love and forgiveness and care and compassion for those who are around us. Well, there's one more reading and then I'll be done. The story in Matthew happens towards the end, Matthew 25. Jesus, throughout the gospel, he begins with a large crowd keeps following him. Everybody wants to hear and see what Jesus is up to. It all seems so grand. It all seems impressive. But then slowly people start to not get it. They start to hear a different tone from Jesus. Jesus begins to talk about what's coming for him. What's coming for him is what we're talking about in Lent. Like, he's beginning the descent, right? He's actually headed to Jerusalem to be crucified and to be killed, right? Stuff's going to get bad. He's almost at his end. He's about to be crucified, cast out of the city into the darkness, where God will have abandoned him, where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. This is the experience that Jesus himself is walking towards. And so Jesus is warning his followers. He's warning the people around him about what they've missed. He's warning them that they've missed that love in the flesh in his flesh, has shown up for them. Right? That life, that light, that mercy, that joy, that peace, it's shown up for them, and they didn't see it. They missed it. It was present to them, and yet they didn't notice. It's as though he himself was this massive gift given to people. This exorbitant wealth of life and grace and mercy and love. And what did they do with it? They just buried it in the ground. So in many ways, Jesus is like the bag of gold. He's this amazing, exorbitant gift that's been buried in the ground. So, what do we do with something like this? Here's what I think we do about it. Or here's what I think we do with it. I think a lot about what we have here. Like what we have even in this group of people right here. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, we're trying to sell our building because we can't afford it anymore. There's not as many people here as there used to be. It's real easy to sort of look back on the golden days and think, man, look how much we've lost. Maybe we are losing building, people, money. Maybe times are hard. Maybe it feels like God has left the building, like he's exited. See, the temptation, and it's as much a temptation for me as I think it is for all of us, is to get fearful. It's to hide. It's to kind of take what little we have and bury it in the ground, protect it, keep it safe. But maybe there's another way to look at it. Maybe we have an exorbitant gift. Maybe we have a bag of gold that we don't know is a bag of gold. I mean, look, we have people here. People with lives. People with experiences. People with wisdom. People with love. People who care about each other. Maybe what we have is an exorbitant gift. It's a bag full of gold. And the question is that what we see? We just see the stuff we think we don't have? Do we see the stuff that we think that we've lost? I don't know about you, but this parable tells me to stop being so fearful, to start seeing everything we have. And maybe it's not just us about us as a church, but maybe it's about us as individuals. Like maybe you just have the one friend that you can call up and have a conversation with when you need to. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's all you have. But man, maybe that friend is a bag of gold. Like maybe that's where life is at. Maybe you just have the one good thing going for you. But maybe that one good thing going for you is the bag of gold. And maybe you're not in the job you wish you were in. But maybe the job that you have is the bag of gold. Like it has this enormous potential for life and grace and love and peace and joy. And so, the question is, what are we going to do with this bag of gold?